It was February 21st, 2003, that the body of 19-year-old Nikki Nicholas was found shot to death in a farmhouse in Green Oak Township on property between M36 and Spicer Road. A Michigan-based podcaster, Stephen Delisle, heard about this case, found out that it was still unsolved, a cold case all these years later, and put together a 6-episode podcast. He's put that on a website, thefarmhousemurder.com. And I'm going to talk with Stephen coming up in just a little bit about how he came to this. But we're going to start off just playing you the trailer for The Farmhouse Murder to give you a sense of the type of story that Stephen was telling.
They seen him in Detroit, and he got in a white truck.
Not knowing where that information comes from, that is not information that I have in any of the reports that I've gone through.
Ebony informed me, called me. She said, "Mom, I think he's dead."
Okay. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's a lot of stuff I didn't like, and, you know, we didn't have no voice. We didn't know what to do. This is, you know, we were stressed out. We don't know.
I didn't even know this place existed.
You know, it kind of runs the gamut. Anything between somebody saying something and something popping up in physical evidence, like I said, could shatter all those walls and bring everything crumbling down to the point where now we've got something viable to work with.
There have been other crimes that we've had that have happened that made people change their behaviors and made them feel a little less safe. I don't think that Nikki's murder was one of those cases.
I want closure. I want somebody, if they will, to tell me what actually happened to my child.
On the night of February 15th, 2003, Nikki left her home in Detroit, got into a white truck, and headed to a house party somewhere between Ann Arbor and Detroit. 6 days later, her body was found in an abandoned farmhouse, frozen solid, with a single gunshot wound to the head. 17 years later, her murder remains unsolved. Let's change that.
Stephen, you first came to my attention. You had actually reached out to me at one point looking for information about this case to put together this podcast. How did this end up on your radar? And then what, you know, propelled you forward to put together this podcast series?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, John. So I was always a big true crime podcast fan, and for the longest time, I kind of wanted to look into something myself, especially after seeing what happened with the podcast Up and Vanished, and some resolution actually came to the case. And I thought, obviously, a very lofty goal and unlikely that I could do something like that, but I thought I'd try my hand on it. So I started looking around at potential local cases. I came across this one on a Reddit forum, actually, of unresolved mysteries or unsolved mysteries. And I started taking a little bit of a look at this. So now this was February 2020, so this is quite some time ago now. And I started to do some Googling, and I found very, very little about it, which kind of intrigued me. So I actually looked up some newspaper archives for the Daily Press and Argus, primarily in a couple of Detroit newspapers. I was able to find this case a little bit more from reporting back when it happened in some kind of anniversary articles. And when I found that, I decided I really wanted to take a deeper look because it looked like it could use some more publicity.
So let's take people back to when this case first came to the attention of the public. As I said, February 21st, 2003, a body found in an abandoned farmhouse on property in Green Oak Township between M36 and Spicer Road. Body turned out to be an individual named Nikki Nicholas, who at the time that this was reported, and again, we have to go all the way back to 2003, the issue of transgender not as well reported or understood, I think, amongst the general public, certainly in the Livingston County area. But at the time, reported to be a 19-year-old named Anthony Nikki Nicholas, who made, as they put it at this time, his living as a female impersonator in Detroit area bars. Since then, of course, sensibilities have modified somewhat and become a little bit more enlightened, and we understand that we really should refer to Nikki as she. In fact, the fact that this murder is unsolved 18 years later, I'm just curious, you're looking into this case, how much you think that the issue of the gender may or may not have had to do with this case?
Yeah, that's really, really tough to answer. Obviously, I've asked that question to quite a lot of folks, local reporters, to the family, to law enforcement, and everybody kind of has the same answer, which is we really don't know. And since we don't know who did it, we don't know a motive. And so tying that together is tough. Personally, I don't have a strong impression that that was necessarily a leading factor. But without knowing more and without sharing more, it would be really difficult to say. So, yeah, that's kind of the difficulty around it for sure.
Because I think for most of the public, that has been the issue that has tied into this case more than the fact that an individual, was murdered and their killers have never been brought to justice. So, you know, having discussed that particular, aspect of this case, what about the murder investigation itself? What were, when you looked into this, how did you proceed? Once you found this case and you said, wow, this is interesting, what did you then do?
Yeah, so and to also hit your last question more, I know it's probably led to the intrigue, Nikki's identity, but for me, and I think for some others too, the intrigue really has been that it seems like there's just one missing link to bringing it all down and getting resolution for Nikki's family. So for me, more than her identity or anything, that's the big thing. And part of that is this, I believe it was the 2012 article about the cold case team, the work they did, where they kind of publicly put a bit of a theory out there. And so that was the other thing where I finally decided to take that next step and say, I want to look into this. Is I saw, okay, 2012, they have a pretty good theory of the case. It's February 2020, and I don't actually see any resolution trying to see what's happened here. So the first thing I actually did was try to find and actually reached out to Nikki's family, her mother, Elfrida. And I first gained her permission to even trudge this up, because I could understand if the family just wanted to put some things behind them, because it would be a bit too painful to participate in a process like this.
And you can get a sense of just how in-depth Stephen went from episode 2, where he talks about this, the episode titled, Who is Nikki?
Elfrida, Nikki's mom, tells us a little bit about Nikki's childhood.
Yes, at this point, I had 5 children. He had one sister, which was the eldest. And Pika was the second from the baby. Well, Pika, he grew up in Detroit on the west and the east side. So he were in the, we moved from the west side to the east side, and he finished growing. And Pika was a happy kid. I mean, I always wanted to dance, or he loved to do hair. Was Pika's thing. So me and Pika, he was just altogether different. I had so many stories I could tell you that was cute and that he'd done. He was about 13, and he was about 12, 13. And at this time, it was the kids called Crisscross. My son, Peter, decided he would go to school and wear his clothes backwards, like Crisscross. He even put the 2 slashes in his eyebrows. Now, mind you, I didn't know he had did this until he got home that day. When he got home, kids like, Mama, look at Peter looking like a stupid old crazy person. Look at him, he looking stupid. Damn, Mama, but look how he looking. I gets up to go see what Peter has on. Peter got his jeans on backwards, his shirt on backwards, and he got these 2 slashes in his eyebrows. I'm looking at him like, are you serious right now? Are you serious? Well, Mama, if Crisscross can do it, I can do it. I'm like, Crisscross, is they making money off theirs. You're not going to get any money. You look at all kind of crazy. My mama, I told you, Chris Cross did it, so I did it.
Now back to Steven.
But fortunately, Elfrida was really, really hungry for someone to do something. So she said, please go do whatever you can, get it back in the public eye. So after that, I reached out to the Green Oak Township Police Department and we exchanged emails, try to get together a few times. I think it actually took a couple months to really connect with Chief Jason Pless and then the investigating officer, Officer Ickes, to get some kind of information or get my bearings on, you know, some of the information that's been out there in the media versus what reality is. Because, you know, reporting in the early days of the investigation, not everything was 100% correct, or there was some contradictory information. So that was kind of the next step after getting permission from Nikki's family, was to start talking to them. And we had many, many, many conversations then over the next, you know, 5, 6, 7 months about all the information. Some things they were willing to share, others they weren't. And from there, you know, just submitted some FOIA requests and got some information, talked to local reporters from the time, talked to different residents and the fire department, really anybody who I could get to talk to me. And some were willing to go on the record and some weren't, and just try to really piece together what I could based on all those different contacts.
Were there some key things that, as you said, that there the difference between what had been reported and what the reality was? What kind of stood out most, the difference in those two?
Well, I would say there wasn't too much that was, say, incorrect. There just wasn't so much that was put out there. And kind of like I was saying, I think there was a lot put on her identity, and that was an important part of her, no doubt. But I just think not so much was about, okay, these are really the circumstances. This is what we know from the days leading up. And I understand probably a lot of that was hindered by law enforcement can only share so much. But really, it just seemed like a lot of the reporting in the early days were just purely a couple basic facts and not too much more to say, hey, you may have noticed her, may have noticed something weird around this day, around this time, and kind of reach out. And so that was something I really wanted to put out there, and you'll notice is really highlighted, which is getting Crime Stoppers involved, as well as trying to just encourage anyone who may have a little bit of a guilty conscience, or someone who maybe knows something that doesn't seem important, or maybe they told someone before. A lot of different agencies have touched this case at different times. I think people take for granted what information may or may not have actually been transferred between different departments, different investigators. So that would be the plea that I think is most important is, really, if you know anything, just speak up, call the Green Oak Township Police Department, and I think it, you know, it could be that one thing that finally breaks the case.
Let's start with the crime scene itself, this abandoned farmhouse where Nicholas's body was found. In terms of what the current police theories are on this, was and I've heard this debated through the years, but you can tell me, you've obviously done more in-depth work on this. So is the theory that Nikki was killed somewhere else and dumped in the farmhouse, or that Nikki was killed at the farmhouse, or is that really not determined?
My understanding of the current theory is that she was incapacitated elsewhere. She was brought to the site alive but incapacitated and murdered in the farmhouse. That's my understanding of the current theory.
And in terms of the evidence that investigators have, I mean, is there, and obviously they're going to be pretty close to the vest on what they do have, but is there, what physical evidence do they have?
They won't share much, obviously, but what we do know is that there is physical evidence in the case. It is still in possession. The Michigan State Police Crime Lab has taken one look at it many years ago, back in, I think it was 2004, maybe it fell into 2005. But in, you know, between 2003 and 2005, the State Police Crime Lab did take a look at that physical evidence. At the time, they were not able to pull a suitable sample from the materials provided, a suitable DNA sample for any sort of comparison purposes. While Chief Plus checks back in with them every 18 to 24 months, so far the answer has always been they don't think technology has yet improved to the point where it would be worth the risk of reevaluating the evidence. Now, you'll hear in the podcast, I'm not sure I really think I totally agree with the risk-reward calculation being made, and, you know, I could be convinced that maybe if I had all the information he has. But just looking at the age of the case and understanding they're very open that that will be, the without, you know, a witness coming forward, that will be the number one thing that will break this case. So, you know, the sooner the better.
It, has a suspect ever been identified? I mean, even not even a, if it's a particular individual, I suppose, but even just a potential suspect pool.
So they were very, very careful to never use the term suspect. For them, they do have persons of interest, which is a very clear line they wanted to draw in the discussions we had. There were four persons of interest they believe could be involved in it. Two, however, are already deceased. From what I understand, two still remain alive. And this is where, you know, my risk-reward calculation maybe differs from theirs. I just see that window for an opportunity to bring justice closing, and I would really like to see, you know, Nikki's family really get the full story on what happened to Nikki, find whatever little bit of closure they can get, and actually see some justice brought. And I think that's where some of the urgency really comes from.
Has Nikki's family had a chance to hear the Farmhouse Murder series, or is that would that be just too painful?
I don't know. I've kept in touch with them prior to publishing. I let them know when it was published, but I don't know if they've actually listened. And it's not something, to be honest, I really wanted to pry. If it's something they're interested in doing, then I'm happy for them to do so. But otherwise, I didn't really want to ask that question, to be honest.
Now, otherwise, what's the response been?
It's been interesting. So I've continued to try to poke around, and especially as people reach out to me here and there about the series. It's been quiet. I've heard some feedback, good and bad, but mostly as I keep talking to people, just people don't really want to seem to get too involved and talk too much. And if they do so, I get a little bit of an information here and there anonymously, but then to finally take the next step seems to always be a bit of a hesitance there. So there is definitely has been some reaction, but a lot of it has not been people really wanting to still talk to me too much more, give me more information. There has been some helpful tips about, you know, what young adults in that age range were doing about that time in the cities of, you know, South Lyon and Green Oak Township. But, again, in taking that next step and sharing a little bit more information, there's been a lot of hesitance.
So, again, the 6-episode podcast series called The Farmhouse Murder. You've got a website, thefarmhousemurder.com. Stephen Delisle, I guess anything else you want to add to this?
Yeah, I know I've said it a couple times already, but really the main thing here is if you know something, please speak up and say something. Otherwise, if, you have the ability, any donations to Crime Stoppers to help really give maybe someone that last bit of motivation would always be appreciated, I'm sure. Otherwise, I appreciate you highlighting this case. Every bit of publicity helps.